What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hi everyone, Connor here. If you don't know already, we have launched Intelligence Squared Premium. For bonus content, early access listens, and exclusive extras, just head to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the episode description. And if you're an Apple Podcasts person, hit subscribe for the bonus extras from your podcasts app too. Thanks again for all your support. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Described as one of the most important and blazingly original writers of his generation, American author George Saunders is a master of the short story. He joins us today on the podcast to discuss the voices that make up his insightful, sometimes hilarious and disturbing stories. Reflecting on his newly released collection of short stories, Liberation Day, George Saunders is joined by critic John Self to explore the voices in his stories and how they cut into the absurdist experience of what it means to be human. Here's John with more.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm John Self and I'm joined today by George Saunders. In 2017, George won the Booker Prize for Lincoln in the Bardo, an experimental novel which explored Abraham Lincoln's grief after the death of his young son, Willie. But today, we're here to speak about his new collection, Liberation Day, a return to his original form, the short story. In 9 stories, which range from a hell-themed section of an underground amusement park to dystopian alternative realities, he manages to cover immense ground, exploring the shared absurdities and horrors of what it means to be human today. George, welcome to Intelligence Squared.
Thank you for having me, John. Nice to be here.
And welcome to the UK. You're here for a few days. Do you get different responses to your work in different countries? Is there a particular type of British George Saunders reader?
I feel very understood here. I've always had a great time here, and people seem to go right to the heart of the book. So it's really, really great.
That's good. That's good. And Liberation Day is your first collection in almost 10 years, as I said at the intro. And after 2 books, which were slight departures for you, a novel and the collection of essays and A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. Does it feel good to be back?
It does. I was kind of writing these stories all through all of that, but to have them all in one place is really nice. That the story form is something I've been doing since I was in my 20s, and it just feels like home. And it feels like in that mode, my subconscious is kind of ornery, you know, and it kind of takes me places I didn't know I was going to go, and teaches me things I didn't necessarily want to know. So it's a good friend.
Yeah. And did you say you've been writing stories since your 20s? I mean, do you still get excited or even nervous when a new book comes out?
Oh, very much. Yeah. It's always, I mean, that's part of it, I think, is to keep the whole thing new. Don't phone anything in, because that's how you become a hack. You know, if you think you know what you're doing, you become a robot. So, you know, writing the stories is always a process of trying to get yourself into trouble a little bit, trying to confuse yourself and get rid of the old tricks. And then you very confidently put them together, and then they go out in the world, and you just have no idea what happens. That's kind of a thrill.
So let's talk about Liberation Day. This is a collection which to my mind, in part, confirms you in your status as the laureate of dystopian historical reenactment theme parks. I mean, there are stories here, thinking of the title story, Liberation Day and Ghoul, where people are living or working or slaving in these places perhaps for the benefit of visitors or for others who may or may not ever turn up. And they're oppressed, but they don't realize they're oppressed, at least to begin with. What is it that draws you to these scenarios?
You know, really, this is kind of a strange answer, but I try not to have any plans about stories when I'm starting. I just want to go where the fun is and where often it's a voice that's kind of in my head and I can't quite figure out where it comes from. So the first step for me is always to try to know as little as possible about the story. You know, don't have any intention, don't have any politics, just launch in and it's almost like stand up. You know, you start doing a little bit of improv where you're channeling a certain voice. And then that's the fun part. And then you have to sort of figure out why is that person talking that way, you know, or what's the situation that caused him to talk that way. So that, in a sense, is plot, really. You know, once you write yourself into a mess and then kind of like Houdini, then you try to get out of it. And so for me, the trick is always to start with anything, really, just literally anything in the world, if it seems like fun. And then through the revision process, you're trying to get it to the point where it would speak to a reader's deep heart. You know, even though it starts in a hell-themed theme park or the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the idea is that by the end of it, the reader's going to feel like, oh, he was going for the deep stuff all along. You know, he was kind of tending the sort of classic work of the short story all along, which is to connect two minds, you know. So it's kind of a fun thing, but the main thing is to baffle yourself, I think. You know, not be in control of it. Because when you're in control of it, you're basically losing contact with the reader. You're sort of phoning it in. Whereas if you're a little confused and you're mindful of the ways in which the reader might be confused, then you can kind of go on that journey together.
And can we talk about the use of language in your stories? I mean, it means that effectively your stories are very difficult to describe, in fact. You know, so but my advice to listeners is just to read them. But because the language is not so much describing the thing as it is the thing, if that makes sense. And in a story like Ghoul, we see the use of these sort of horrible mimsy euphemisms, you know, where a character, the narrator describes, he refers to certain recent undesirable occurrences. One of what he means is people being kicked to death. And is it fair to say that a theme of your work is how we use language to conceal as much as we do to reveal?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's even kind of, to my ear, a little bit of poetry in that concealment. You know, if somebody is, for example, in the corporate world where I used to work, you know, there's a formula for avoiding saying the unpleasant thing that would implicate you. And so, you know, if you think of poetry as being language, it's somehow full of life because of intention, then that corporate speak is sort of a form of diabolical poetry. But really, you know, at another level, I think, you know, I teach writing. And one of the things I've noticed is that a person kind of has to use what they have. And this whole sort of craft trajectory is just a process of finding out what you've got that maybe other people don't. And so for me, ever since I was young, I have a very busy, too busy mind, and have always had also a lot of fun with kind of verbal jokes, you know, doing impersonations. And when we were kids, the highest form was to invent a character, give that character a voice and create a sort of a biography for that person and then stay in character for a while until you were really annoying. So that's something that I don't know why, but I just enjoy it. So that was really my pathway into fiction, is to just do these voices and move around, especially with working class and corporate language, and just try to find the poetry in them.
Really. Yeah. And what that means is when we have that corporate language or those euphemisms, what it means that when someone does speak plainly to us, it cuts through us. You know, there's a line in Ghoul where there's a letter and someone says, "What a joke, the way we live." You know, the worry, the suspicion, the stress, the meanness, and it just, you know, it sort of hit me much harder than it would have if this had been a story just written in a kind of a blank register, if you like.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. And it's kind of like that in life, isn't it? Every so often, you know, we've got these elaborate structures for falsity, actually, you know, and every so often somebody gets desperate and speaks a simple truth and you think, oh my God, thanks for that.
Yeah. And we should say that, you know, we've talked about hell-themed amusement parks and the terrible things that your characters undergo, but we should say these stories are very funny, but also very sad and often moving at the same time. And each quality, in a sense, intensifies the other. Are you using comedy as a way of lowering the reader's defenses, or is it just a vision of the way you see the world?
I think it's probably the first more. You know, it's a little bit, I think the stories are a bit like I'm on the motorcycle and you're in the sidecar. And I'm trying to, through tone of voice, I'm trying to keep you close to me in the sidecar. So when I go left, you go left. When I go right, you go right. If there's something distancing, then I go left and you don't hear about it for 40 minutes and we're out of connection. So I think the humor is a way of kind of, you know, reaching over and patting the reader's hand and saying, yeah, this is a crazy situation, I know. And it is a way of actually two sides. One is kind of a sentimental Khalil Gibran sort of person, you know, and the other one is deeply Chicago sarcastic and dark. So I think in a certain way, I'm just sort of turning on and turning off those two sides to keep you with me. So if I get a little bit too sort of elegiac and serious, and I see you drifting off to sleep, I'll do a fart joke. Suddenly you're back in it. And part of that, part of the dynamic of that is now suddenly you don't know who I am anymore. You thought you had me pegged as the elegiac guy. Well, with the fart joke, suddenly you're reinterested again because you can't quite make sense of who I am. So I think part of that, you know, it's a bit of a seduction in that you're trying, you know, the ultimate goal is to keep the reader on the line. Because if you don't, then you don't get anything. You don't get theme, you don't get politics. So it's kind of, I suppose, in a certain way, a charm offensive. And each writer has to kind of find out what she has to offer. And then, you know, we might see form and structure and all that. It's just patterns of bringing the different gifts to bear, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. But you said there about, you know, if you sense that you're losing the reader at a particular point. I mean, do you have trusted readers that you discuss your work with, or do you just trust your own ear?
For most of it, I'm kind of sort of mentally imitating a first-time reader, which of course is impossible. But what you're trying to do is pretend that you haven't read the thing 1,000 times and say, okay, if I hadn't, where would I be? So I do, that's most of it. It's just that kind of impersonation. And at the very end, I'll give it to my wife, and she's a very good reader, and also a very, she's got no poker face. So if she doesn't like it, I can just see it on her face. And if she does, she responds very genuinely and emotionally. So that's kind of the big checkpoint for me, that one. But mostly it's kind of, you know, trying to see if I hadn't read this before, where would I be right now? What would I be expecting? Based on that, do I have a way of confounding my own expectations? So it's kind of an insane process, really, but you actually can get better at it, which is strange.
Yeah. And effective the way that you use language in stories and the voice in stories is that you tend to throw the reader in unprepared, and they have to do a little bit of work. And that's not that common an approach. You know, I think of people like, you know, William Golding or Kazuo Ishiguro, and both Nobel Prize winners, by the way, though I'm not making any promises. But what are the benefits of that approach to the reader and to the writer, where you have to do that little bit extra work to get into the story?
Right. Well, that, I think that kind of comes out of my attempt to be truthful to the experience of the character. So in that story, Ghoul, you know, this guy works in an underground hell theme park, but he doesn't think much of it. He's never known anything else. So he's not going to stop and say, hello. You know, this is, you're underground, and anything he tells us, he's going to tell us at speed, in the same way that he would talk to a colleague at work. So in a way, it's just authenticity. You know, if you have a story on a fishing boat, the character doesn't stop and explain all the rigging. He already knows it. So that's kind of the one level. And the second level is, I think, to do with the thrill of the chase. You know, if I go into a story a little faster than you're used to without the expositional superstructure, then it always reminds me a bit of going to a museum tour, you know, and a tour guide who's a little manic says, come on, let's go, and sprints off. You know, your inclination is to follow, and you hear her and she's in the middle of a sentence, you haven't quite caught it, then, you know, you're still interested. So I think part of that, the overall dynamic that I see is, at the beginning of the story, you doubt me. Why are you going so fast? Why aren't you stopping to explain? I'm trying to give you just enough to keep you following me. Perhaps a little grouchily, you know, but along the way, I keep throwing little tidbits. So the world starts to take more form in your mind. And by the end, you're a full participant. And the hope is that somehow that means of expression, well, it'll teach you to read the story, first of all. And then by the end, that'll have a greater effect than if I told it to you in a more straightforward way. You know, with Lincoln and the Bardo, that was the whole thought, is I'm going to rather, you know, maybe painfully teach you the method of this book in the first 30 pages, which will definitely cause some people to bail out, which it turns out it did. But then if we can do that construction project together and you understand the sort of unspoken rules of engagement, then theoretically there's a big payoff for you at the end when this language and structural language that we developed together gets you into a deeper place than you otherwise could have been put.
And you mentioned Lincoln and the Bardo just then. I'm wondering if the, I mean, I'm guessing that it won you a new readership or a wider readership. And I remember Julian Barnes in a similar situation saying that you know, he had mixed feelings about that because he quite liked his own readership. But does that mean that you've had any sense of, when you've been writing new stories, a sort of a sense of serving that new readership who may not be familiar, or do you stick with your vision?
It's kind of like that, but maybe a more positive thing, which is it with that book, I took a little bit of a stretch, in my mind anyway, towards, I guess, a broader palette, you know, a little, it's not really a realistic book, but it's emotionally more realistic than maybe the other stories. So the fact that it got the prize and got the readership, I feel a little bit emboldened, you know, especially to try to invoke sort of positive valences, you know, to try to praise what is praiseworthy. And, you know, it's probably not the best that I need confidence. I need a prize to do that. But somehow it's just the idea that, you know, suddenly, oh, I actually can talk to more people than I thought I could. You know, I can maybe have a story that appeals to people beyond the literary circle a little bit. So that's kind of my, you know, that was always my goal. I think I grew up thinking, you know, Hemingway, thinking Dickens, and Toni Morrison later, people who really spoke to everybody. So, but it's, you know, in a sense, it's a technical problem. You sort of begin with something edgy and dark and somewhat excluding of certain people. Now that the race is to kind of open off a little bit and be more confident and more inclusive.
Just a reminder, you can support Intelligence Squared and get even closer to the world's most brilliant minds by signing up for Intelligence Squared Premium. Head to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description to get started. And Apple folks, we've got you covered too. Hit subscribe for some bonus extras on your podcast app. Thanks for all your support. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And 1, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code SQUARED. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experienced experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You mentioned earlier how you start with the voice for your stories, and in your last book, in A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, you said that writing for you was more of a feeling process than a thinking process, something like that. I wanted to talk about the story. One of my favorites in the collection, in the new collection, is A Thing at Work, where you have this middle class and working class employee clashing, and their sort of manager caught in the middle, and it's driven narratively by these sort of freewheeling, very funny internal monologues. Can you talk a little bit about how that story, which voice did you start with? How did that story come about?
Yeah, I started years ago, maybe 10 years ago, with the Brenda, the working class woman, kind of loosely, not as, there was somebody I worked with back at in the tech writing days who disappeared from work for about 10 days. And it turns out she'd been in jail for bouncing checks. And it was a very sweet person. And so I wasn't really thinking about her, but of that circumstance of somebody who's, you know, coming into a corporate environment, trying to sort of put on a certain a face, but in life is really suffering and it's just barely making it. So she was first. And then there were a lot of versions that I didn't quite know what to do with it. And then at one point, I introduced a second character who was harshly judging that woman, kind of a reader surrogate saying, oh, gosh, you know, you don't want to talk to her because she just goes on and on. And she's, you know, a little bit of class snobbery. And that seemed to be the thing that opened it up, was a little bit of a rivalry between those two. But that story, I enjoy that kind of story where I actually have three different points of view in it. So it starts off to be, I think, a bit of a comic put down of that woman, really. And then as you keep concentrating on each person, it becomes a little bit holographic, and you can kind of see, you know, in this very small way, what human tragedy is, which is three monkey minds sitting in their offices, churning, telling their version of something. And then you go into the hallway and you get, you know, get the explosion of those competing views.
10 years, did you say that story started off? So this is a very long process. You put a story down and come back to it, or let your subconscious work on it, as I think Martin Innes tends to talk about. Is that?
Yes, because with this one, I had an idea of what it was. And every time I tried it, it just would kind of lock up. So at that time, I would just say, well, yeah, there's three or four good pages there. Let's just put it down and come back. And then when you come back, you can sort of see the stuff that's impeding you, you know, the kind of stuff that's just in there because they typed it. So you strip that away. So it's a lot of patience, you know, really, like, and it's interesting as a teacher of writing, you think you should be more efficient than, I think I should be more efficient than I am. But part of that job is really to say, well, you're just not ready yet. You know, that there will be a story that comes out of this, but if you start stage managing it, that's the worst thing you could do. So I put it down. And then there's a lot of, I think of it as Rubik's Cube work, where with this one, I had the second voice of this woman, Jen. And I actually had a third voice that I ended up taking out. And so you're just kind of playfully, you know, moving parts around, clipping off the end and moving them. And you're hoping for two sections to speak to each other in some way that seems undeniable. And then the other moment is just that moment when somehow somebody says something that gets my attention. And I think, oh, okay, you said that. The world is going to respond this way and test you. Like in a story from 10th of December called Victory Lap, there was a moment where there was this young, very innocent, kind of sweet girl. And she's musing to herself and she says, you know, to be good, all you have to do is be good. You know, which is something at 15, I thought, you know, like, well, it's so easy. What's with all these divorces and addictions, you idiots? You know, just be good. So I, you know, that was just a sort of a riff, really. Just she says this. And then the sort of narrative part of yourself says, oh, wait a minute, say that again. To be good, all you have to do is be good. Ah, okay. So now I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to see if that's true or not. Let's see if you can be good under pressure, you know? So it's one of the benefits of the voice is it actually generates plot if you're listening carefully.
And then I suppose then that, you know, if you're following that process, there must be a risk of not knowing when to stop or what, maybe wanting to keep working it sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. And then I, you know, one of the sort of the loose theories that I have about the story is that, okay, you've got the overstory, which is what's actually happening day to day and who lives, who dies, and so on. But then all along, there's an understory that I think is related to Joyce's epiphany, you know, but there's something going on under the story that you as the writer don't really know about, but the story's cooking it up. And the idea is that by the end, it will dawn on you at speed. It'll suddenly break through the surface. So in this one, it really had to do with the decision that the boss has to make about whether to fire this woman or not. I didn't know that for many months, but then it came up. So then once you feel that, you say, okay, that was actually what the story was about, is would this man who's had a long memory about his beloved mother, who was similar to this working class woman, would he support her or not? Once you realize that, then when that decision gets taken, the story is actually over and you should rush for the exit. So the understory has revealed itself. Then that's it. We don't care about the postscript. We don't care about the next day. We just care about that. So there's, as you suggest, there's a lot of overwriting, writing the next two or three days and going, you know, actually nothing happens there that escalates. So we can just leave it. And the essential curiosity of the reader had been answered by that, the understory coming up.
And speaking of that's a workplace story, I think at work. And speaking of workplaces, I mean, my copy of your first book, Civil War Landed by Decline, says, George Saunders works as a geophysical engineer in Rochester, New York. Do you miss that time when you worked as well as writing? I know you teach creative writing, but it's all in the same build, I guess.
I miss the, the immersion in, I mean, at that time we had no money and, you know, I was working full time, writing on the bus, writing at night. So I kind of missed that sense of being, well, I don't know if I miss it, but the sense of being under the foot of the culture was kind of, you know, productive. But what I've done is try to simulate that. Like, I do some journalism trips for the New Yorker and for GQ. So the idea is to just sort of try to work yourself into a state of confusion. Because I think one of the curses of being old is that you know, the mind starts to solidify. I know what's true. I know my politics. I know the world, which for an artist is death. You know, you have to be really unsure every time. So I just sort of try to get out into the world enough to overthrow that, you know, that sense of certainty that comes with age.
And another of my favorite stories in the book was The Mom of Bold Action, which is this woman who's she's a writer and she's scrabbling around and desperately in her life for ideas for stories. You know, the trusty little opener, the discontented dog, the peanut butter thingy. And I wondered if, you know, do you actively seek out ideas for stories? Do you wait for things to come to you? Does either have a better hit rate?
You know, I'm a real scavenger. Like that beginning, that story came out of another story from years ago. And I had a scene in there of a mother waiting for her kid to come home. It didn't work in that story. They had some good jokes in it, really, so a good riff, you know. So I just plucked it out and saved it. And then just sort of by coincidence was reading it. Oh, that's kind of fun. And, you know, we talked earlier about trying to befuddle yourself. And if I take a fragment like that and you free it from the original matrix, then you're giving it a lot of autonomy. It's going to tell you what it wants you to do next. So I'm a real a recycler, you know. Something if I can stumble onto a good riff, I'll just keep it around forever. And I suppose in the, you know, if I had a blank page, yeah, it's just voice, you know. I make sure not to have actually in that story, her problem is she wants to vet every story. She has an idea, she tells it through the end, and then she discards it. And that's familiar to me, you know, that feeling where you say, I'll write the story, but only if it'll be good, you know. Well, that, you know, so she's got a little bit of a completion problem because she completes the stories in her mind and then decides they're no good. So for me, the part of the thing is if I can start something, not have any idea if it'll be good, not have any idea what it wants to be, then I'm really happy. And the minute I start to have a plan, I know I'm in trouble.
So. Yeah, and interestingly, of course, the one time when she does find herself gripped by the news is whenever she's writing her essay of her what has happened to her son, or, you know, and that's a really interesting moment, isn't it?
Well, I think there her sin is that she writes it, but she doesn't revise it, you know. so she does her first draft, and it's quite, I think it's a kind of a reactionary extreme piece. But she doesn't reread it and change it. And then the next person who reads it is her husband. And he gets the kind of evil power of it and goes out and does something stupid. It's tough being a writer. You know, you have to.
Yeah, for sure. And you've always in your stories warned us about the dangers of allowing ourselves to stop thinking, or rather to have our thinking dictated by what others want us to think. But in these stories, there seems to be maybe a little more pessimism about the benefits of resistance. Is that fair? I mean, the story Love Letter sounds very much like, I was going to say post-Trump America, perhaps I should say inter-Trump America, my God.
Yeah, you know, to me, they're hopeful stories, just, I think, because they're true to their beginnings. You know, in other words, for me, uplift or hope or that is, it has to do with the story staying artistically true to itself. So when I read the end of a Flannery O'Connor story, which are never peppy, you know, I feel uplifted because I've seen someone do their work really well and honor the truth. But also, I would have to confess that the last 5 or 6 years, you know, it dawns on one that sometimes things turn out badly. And, you know, sometimes your will isn't enough to overturn a situation, or a country can get itself into a position where it makes a huge mistake. So I think in these stories, as opposed to the ones in 10th of December, I was trying to, in 10th of December, I was trying to find moments where people could do something that would cause a positive outcome, you know, sort of a quiet heroism. And I just was intrigued by that. And I kept finding opportunities for that in the stories and then thinking, well, actually, that's the most authentic thing I could do. The most original thing I could do is steer the story toward the happy outcome if I could make it work. This time, there were several points. It happened in Ghoul. It happened in Liberation Day. It happened in A Thing at Work, where I could see where I could guide it that way. But something about it, given the preceding parts of the story, was false. It would have been a kind of a bullshit way of saying all is well, when the story seemed to be saying, well, sometimes all is not well, at least on the immediate level. Now, the way I find hope in these stories is that in every single one of them, somebody starts off deluded or tricked or, you know, out of touch with reality, and then stumbles toward a more accurate understanding of the situation, which isn't always a, you know, a party. But at this point, I think that's, you know, in a sense, as a country, that's what we're trying to do, is say, oh, can we get back in touch with some kind of truth, you know, some kind of reliable and mutually shared view of reality.
Yeah. We'll take what we can get at this stage, I think. It's 26 years now, I think, since your first book was published, at least in the UK.
And I'm only 30. It's impossible.
Well, what have you learned, George? Does it get easier?
I would say it does, yes. Because the one thing that's changed is I've kind of divested myself of the narrative of the muse. You know, the idea that you either have it or you don't, or this is the wrong story to be writing. And I've kind of relaxed into an answer that says, well, if a story is confounding you, it just wants to be something you're not ready for yet. You know, it's kind of a sense of patience that, and even enjoyment. If a story is kind of kicking my ass a little bit, I think, oh, that's fun. This will be a really good one because it's so disobedient, you know, that kind of feeling. Yeah. So it's been, I mean, actually, it's been such a rich thing, you know, to have with me all these years. And it's sort of like a record of, I would say, sort of like a record of my best self. You know, if I look at my actual life during that period, it's kind of a, you know, mid-level anxious dope, really. You know, nothing, always a little behind the news, you know, and a little insufficiently tender and all that. But at the same time, the subconscious was spitting out these stories that are smarter than that person, actually. And I think they're also more empathetic than that person, you know. So that it's been a really lovely companion all these years.
And you teach, we mentioned earlier, you teach creative writing at Syracuse University. What do you learn from your students?
Well, the biggest thing is just that, you know, talent is always with us. As you get older, there's sort of a tendency to, ever since 1982, it's all been downhill. Every fall, so have this group of 6 students that we've chosen from 700 applicants, you know, so they're extraordinary writers and people. Then suddenly you think, okay, so the burden is on me to understand the way they're trying to communicate. And the burden is on me to try to be helpful to them. And then, you know, also just that beautiful feeling of being paid to foster tenderness towards these people, you know, to say, well, if I could possibly help them on their path, that would be so wonderful, you know. So then you become a better listener. You're constantly calling in to question your own aesthetic values, which tend to get rigid. So it's just a wonderful, I mean, selfishly, it's just a wonderful thing to be always forced off autopilot. With those students, if you go in with even a slightly lazy agenda, though, I mean, they're very nice about it, but you can feel that they won't take it, you know. So it's
We know about your love for the 19th century Russians, of course, but which contemporary writers do you recommend to our listeners?
I'm a big fan. I'm in awe of Marlon James. I think what he does is so incredible, and kind of just big Faulknerian Toni Morrison type novels. He's somebody I'm really keen on right now. I just read a really wonderful book by Jonathan Dee, who's a colleague of mine at Syracuse, called Sugar Street. And it's just a little punch, a little Dostoevskian punch. I won't give it away, but it's got one of the most shocking endings, you know, and it was just been perfectly built to. And that was exciting to read. There's a short story writer who actually was a student of ours named Rebecca Curtis, who I think is a little bit undervalued, but she's got a book called 50 Grand and funny, dark, and just so confident. I've also been reading Brandon Taylor, writes some really wonderful short stories. Yeah, so I kind of had about a 3-year lapse in contemporary because of the Russians. I was reading basically the same 8 stories for 2 or 3 years. So I'm trying to catch up now.
Good stories to read it for 3 years, though. George, I mean, you've won awards. You're widely read. I'm just wondering what at this stage in your career, what success means to you as a writer. I mean, is it down to the screen and the what Frank O'Connor called the happiness of getting it down right, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, what having a longer career is really nice because you can sort of separate out the pleasures. So there's definitely the pleasure of getting attention. That's something I have always enjoyed and finally admitted that I enjoy. There's the pleasure of traveling in support of the book. That's fun. But the one that seems to last is the thrill of the hunt, you know, to be sitting in front of a 2-page piece of crap that you wrote. And then say, okay, I know this. I can, if I abide with this, I can get it. And then that process of abiding has to do with all these nice virtues like patience, faith. You know, you have to actually think somewhat deeply about other people's experience. So I think what I've really come to value is just that moment when a story starts to open up to you and you think, yeah, this one might work. And you know, you've got several months ahead of you of deep digging. That doesn't change. That's something you can really count on. The rest of it is kind of circumstantial, but I always think it's like when a sculptor, first the face starts to come out of the stone and you're like, oh, this story is going to tell me something I didn't know. And it'll be beautiful if I keep working. That's the moment that I kind of live for.
George, thank you very much. That was George Saunders, author of Liberation Day, which is available now from Bloomsbury. I've been John Self. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Head to iq2premium.supercast.com for even more content made just for our premium listeners, including extended Q&As, event discounts, and our newsletter too. Thanks for being a part of Intelligence Squared.